Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation is with Mark R. Stoll, Associate Professor of History and Director of Environmental Studies at Texas Tech University. His book, Inherit the Holy Mountain, Religion and the Rise of American Environmentalism, published by Oxford University Press, is the topic of this show. Stoll offers a history of environmentalism emerging from a religious aesthetic and moral vision. He argues that environmentalism began with Calvinist theological commitments regarding the divine's relationship with nature and humanity. The Reformed branch of Christianity held that God spoke through Scripture and the book of nature. Believers expressed this idea not only in literature, but also through landscape paintings and a tradition of natural science and conservation. Preferring unpeopled landscapes, art was to capture both the truth of God's creation and the sublime and the beautiful. Humanity had a moral responsibility to preserve the land for the common good and future generations. The book is filled with creative and colorful characters, well-known and lesser-known, whose commitment to preserving the earth was undergirded by religious ideals. The children of the Reformed tradition promoted biological holism, nature's unity and diversity, and gave birth to ecology, conservation, and land improvement. The national parks, American cities, and agriculture all bear their imprint. By 1870, the Reformed tradition faded, and conservation and ecology were taken up by the Transcendentalists, Progressive Presbyterians, and denominations with an individualistic ethic, such as the Baptists, to shape modern environmentalism. Stoll demonstrates how the children of these traditions challenge the often assumed divide between religious ideas and environmentalism. Here is my conversation with Mark R. Stoll. Now, let me introduce you to the author, Mark Stoll. Mark, thank you for coming to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Your book is a rich history of environmentalism. It crosses many divides, and I think we have a lot to talk about. But before we get into the book, tell us about yourself, your background, how you came to write this book, Inherit the Holy Mountain.
Thank you, Lillian. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk to you. I teach environmental history and American environmental history and American religious history here at Texas Tech University, Lubbock, Texas, out on the South Plains. Excuse me. I got my doctorate from University of Texas at Austin back in 1993, and had lived in California before that for 10 years in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'd always had an interest in the environment growing up, but it was in California that I really got addicted to the outdoors and backpacking and joined the Sierra Club back in 1981. When I went back to graduate school in 1987, I was looking for a topic for my first research paper in my very first research class going back to graduate school. And I had just recently read a biography of John Muir, the famous founder of the Sierra Club and nature writer, kind of hero of the environmental movement. John Muir had an interesting background. He was raised what today we would call fundamentalist, extremely strict Christianity of a Scottish Calvinist type. And according to the wisdom of the day, there was a tension between Christianity and the environment, even an opposition. The sort of poster child for that was James Watt, Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, who was a Pentecostal and was distinctly opposed to the environmental movement. And so he sort of becomes a symbol of that. So I was wondering, how does a man go from being just having this really religious background to being this hero of the environmental movement? The thought of the day was that you have to reject Christianity in a way. You have to leave it in order to become environmentally friendly. And although he did reject his background, it seemed to me that, excuse me, that a person does not just you never leave behind that person you were as a child. It puts a spin on you that you never quite leave behind. We all of us who've have a religious background, we still have that inner Presbyterian, that inner Catholic, that inner Baptist that will be with us always, no matter where we go, converting to Buddhism or becoming an atheist or staying the same religion. There is something that puts a mark on you. So I was wondering, what are the continuities there? And this is really where my research started, was thinking about how did his background actually in some ways prepare him to be this environmental figure. My first book was a kind of an exploration of that, looking at environmentalists and industrialists and comparing their backgrounds. Interestingly, most of them came from the same sort of background, a very similar Calvinistic kind of background. You sort of expect it for the industrialists, but why was it that so many environmentalists were also coming from the same background? As I was doing the revisions to that book, came out in 1997. It's called Protestantism, Capitalism, and Nature in America. As I was doing revisions, I began to realize that you can see continuities between, or definite patterns between, the denomination in which you were raised and the kind of environmentalist you might become as an adult. There were distinct relationships. People who were Congregationalist or Presbyterian or Methodist or Baptist or Catholic or Jewish would tend to think about the relationship between society and nature and the value of nature in very similar ways. So there's a kind of a framework that gets impressed on you. And that's how this book started, was basically looking at the different denominations to try to link together how your denomination of upbringing related to the your attitudes towards nature and the environment as an adult.
Well, your book does a lot more than what you just described, even though what you describe is there.
That's just where it started.
That's where it started. But you make these incredible links between religion, environmentalism, and art, which was unexpected for me. It was new. I had never thought of it that way. And one of the first things you talk about is Calvinism, the Puritans, and how the Puritans viewed nature and their relationship to nature and God's relationship to nature. And I thought that whole section was extremely interesting. So what was the view of nature of the Puritans?
Well, the Puritans, who would be Congregationalists in America, Congregationalists and Presbyterians in Britain, had this sort of Calvinism in common with one another. We today tend to have a kind of a negative attitude towards Calvinism. The first thing that comes to mind is predestination and all that harsh fire and brimstone sermons. And it's really, very few of us think very positively of Calvinism. But Calvinism was quite rich and was interesting to discover how rich its thought was about nature. Calvinists, because they do believe in predestination. Predestination only makes sense if you look at everybody as utterly depraved and deserving of hell, except for those few people that God in his mercy has chosen to be saved. If you're going to deserve hell, you're going to have to be pretty bad. So we are all depraved in Calvinism, tend towards sin. That negativism is balanced by an really remarkably positive attitudes towards nature. Nature comes straight from the hand of God, unlike the things that we create, which are for fallen purposes. Humans create things for their own purposes, and usually sin is involved in there somewhere. Nature comes straight from the hand of God and must be therefore good and pure and reflect God's. Calvin describe nature as the theater of God's glory. You go out there, he can talk about nature in ways that make you think he's almost Emerson or John Muir or something. Nature is where God draws closest to us. We're closest to the Spirit of God when we walk out into nature. And he, in a sense, communicates himself to us in nature.
Yeah, so there's two things going on there. There's a sort of an stance that looks at humanity is depraved and evil, but nature in a way is virtuous. It's the opposite of man.
And you find all sorts of comments by the Puritans that they like to go and meditate in nature, and you know, it's a place for them to get away from people and to really think of things of God. And the Puritan ministers from the earliest days are recommending Puritans get away from other people, get out, find a place by yourself out in a beautiful spot to pray every day or to do your Bible reading or whatever.
Well, it's interesting that view that humanity is a negative view of humanity and a positive view of nature is something. It kind of runs in some of the arguments that you hear much later, where people who are against the environmental movement are going to say the environmentalists are against people. Mm-hmm. They love nature so much that they don't want to think about what's good for people. They'll put a tree before a human being.
Exactly, the tree huggers. Right. Like many stereotypes, there's a grain of truth in these things. There is an expectation amongst the Calvinists that we're going to misbehave. That when we get turned loose in nature, bad things are going to happen. It's going to be exploited for human greed and avarice to make people richer, and God's beauty in nature is going to be destroyed. And it's not really unfair to look at it that way. You can see many examples of exactly that happening.
So the one thing that you talk about is they refer to the book of nature. There was the scriptures, and then there was the book of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Did they put it on the same plane as the revelation that was in scripture?
Well, in many ways they are, because both the Bible and nature come from the hand of God, and therefore they must agree with one another. That's the logic behind it. It's not, of course, invented by the Calvinists, because it's a very, very old Christian idea. It goes back to the 4th century at least. That God would not have locked up all knowledge of him and his attributes in a book that's in languages almost no one can read. You know, back traditionally for hundreds of years, very few people could read. And they certainly couldn't read Hebrew and Greek. So if you just said that the Bible had all the truth in it, it would only be available to a tiny few. So the argument, this is in St. Paul, actually, the argument that that you can tell there is a God, and you can tell that God is good and wise, you can tell by looking at nature. But it doesn't mean that the Bible is just a duplicate, that knowledge of salvation is only in the Bible. There are things that are in the Bible that are not in nature, so they sort of save themselves with that catch there.
You take this philosophy of the Calvinists regarding nature and how it's actually an aid in spiritual life, because mm-hmm. you go to pray and you get you feel connected to God, and you get away from people who are depraved. Then you go into the Hudson River School of Art. You talk about the first person you talk about is Thomas Cole, and then you talk about Frederick Church. And about the unpeopled landscapes that they produced, and why landscape painting was sort of, in a way, unique in America, the way the landscapes were painted. Talk about that. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, you mentioned that you were surprised. You know, to go back a little bit, you mentioned that you're surprised to have art in there. The reason I was thinking about using art was that it would be a way of getting inside the mind of the painter. So the painter coming from a specific religious tradition will be trying to portray nature in a certain way. And it's so it was kind of fun to interpret these paintings, to look at them and to see what's being put in them, what's being left out. For example, the Calvinists tend to make people very small or like to leave them out altogether, because presence of people detracts from the beauty of God's landscape. So this is where my interest in the paintings begins. And so there's a lot of paintings in the book as we go through the different denominations and time periods.
Now, this was interesting in contrast to the Calvinist attitude towards art in general. They were opposed to images, and they cleared out all their churches of any images that, you know, that they would consider that's part of the Catholic sort of tradition.
Right.
And so you talk about a reformed aesthetic. Talk a little bit about that. Because all of a sudden, you've got landscape paintings becoming pretty much acceptable and encouraged.
Well, the Calvinists had this problem that the imagery used religiously was idolatry, that you were distracted by the images. You would be so admiring of the skill of the artist or the sculptor that you would be thinking of the created, you know, creature, people, as opposed to be thinking of the creator. So it was making, if you heard beautiful, the same thing about music. If you heard beautiful music, you'd be thinking, oh, what a wonderful composer, or how beautifully this is being played, rather than your mind going to God. So they were extremely strict about images in the church. And wherever Calvinism went, they just completely whitewashed the walls and took out all the statues and smashed them or got rid of them. So that you could see incredible destruction in areas that were Calvinist of the old medieval churches. So that meant how could you use art? For Calvin, everything you do must in some sense be for the greater glory of God. So how could art be used for God? For Calvin, there were two different ways that art was probably most acceptable. One was to portray people who are, despite predestination and depravity, we are still, you know, the crown of creation. We are created in God's image. But it was also a reminder, as we looked at the painting of ourselves, that we're getting older, and it was a reminder of our mortality, and put into mind higher things. So there the portraiture was fine. And the other thing was the painting the works of God in nature. The Calvinists were also fine with didactic sort of images. So you'll begin to find illustrated religious works and eventually religious Bibles. So illustrations that are uplifting and going to improve you in some sense, or put your mind into a holier spot, is better. Art for art's sake, they couldn't understand. That's just to glorify man. It had no higher purpose.
Now, this reform aesthetic that you talk about in the landscape paintings that came through, you had to capture the truthfulness
exactly
of
right.
nature in the sublime, so that the painting would lift your spirits and point you to the truth that was in nature and the sublime that could not be captured, really. It was a pointer to something else. It wasn't exactly. supposed to draw attention to itself, the painting.
Exactly. What was the first point you made?
The truthfulness and the sublime as being the two parts of the Reform aesthetic.
The Puritans were, and Calvinists are obsessed with hypocrisy. Hypocrisy was a lie. And this is why Puritans hated the theater so much, is because everybody up there was lying. It really distressed them when an actor might actually begin to cry as part of the role. There's a line in Shakespeare, you know, there's the play in the play, I think it's in Hamlet, where the actor begins to say his lines and begins to weep. And then Hamlet marvels, what is Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that you, I forget exactly the line, but he marvels that he should be able to emote like that. And it really disturbed the Calvinists, because if you could fake people out on stage, you could certainly do it in real life. You could certainly do it, make people think that you were a holy person when in reality you were not. Pretend to be a holy person. So they, lying was really, really bothered them, and they really wanted the truth of something. So this is another reason why Calvinist paintings, we see it in the Dutch paintings, we see it in the English landscape tradition, and then in the Hudson River School, like Thomas Cole, an obsession with detail and getting details right. And now the painting itself might be a pure composition. This is okay. But the tree must be an actual tree. You know, the form of the leaf must reflect an actual leaf in nature. The rocks, the form of the rocks should be geologically correct. And as time went on, and science advanced in the 19th century, the paintings became more and more and more detailed until you get Frederick Church and his paintings that were so detailed, people would look at them with opera glasses to see all the incredible detail he put in them.
Now, the Calvinist view of nature didn't just affect art, but it also affected, you talked about the influence that they had on scientific study of nature.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what came out of that? What was the point of the scientific study of nature?
Traditionally, amongst all Christians, science was a religious pursuit because you're studying the works of God. But as the Puritans became more obsessed with that aspect, they became, and of course you are closer to God when you're out in nature, they became more and more interested in natural science. And so it's kind of explosion of natural science in Britain and America, in these sort of Protestant areas in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. That's a reflection of that. So there's a connection between religious principles and investigating nature. There's also, they're looking for the attributes of God in nature. And one of the attributes of ways to see God is to look at the incredible interconnectedness of nature, which, of course, as everybody was until Darwin, everybody was a creationist. It had to have been put there by God, and this plant was meant for that animal to eat and so on, and everything in this incredible interconnectedness. Unity and diversity is the way they would put it in the early 19th century. And so this actually is proto-ecology, the study of how things all link together. It will lead to Darwin. It leads to ecology later in the 19th century. So it's kind of the basis for ecological thinking.
They were also interested, you point out, in stewardship, humanity being a steward of the land and improving the land and taking care of it. So that this would drive them to science to figure out how to best steward the land.
Exactly. Because we're selfish creatures, sinful and so on, we are not supposed to live for ourselves. If we're going to be true Christians, we should live, A, for the glory of God, and B, to benefit the society. We're not supposed to live for ourselves. We should be useful to society. So everything that is about us, everything we have, from our talents and skills to our possessions, our land, we're supposed to use for the benefit of other people. And this is the basis for the modern idea of stewardship. As Calvin put it, that if you have a piece of land, let you so treat it that you hand it on in as good or even better condition than you got it.
So there was a sense that they had a sense of the common good, taking care of nature for the common good. And also they had a sense of future generations, of leaving something even better than what they had been given for the future.
Exactly. This is really visible in Puritan communities in the classic New England town that the Puritans founded, that they had a strong communal ethic in the town. Basically, the town had more valuable than the individuals in it, and you were supposed to improve the town. And the town, of course, wants to leave resources and landscape and so on in make it available to future generations. Part of this is kind of a policy to prevent poverty. The Calvinists believe that poverty resulted from sin when people greedily got everything and left other people with nothing. If you were poor, you were unable to use your talents for the greater good or for the glory of God. You're so busy trying to just keep body and soul together or to feed your family that you can't use your talents. So they believed that a true godly society would not have poverty. So when they set up the New England towns, they gave land to all town members. Everybody had enough land, and they had enough of the all different kinds of land to have a true sustainable agriculture. The Puritan town was the first sustainable just society in America, perhaps the only one we really have been able to create here as a society rather than just a small community or some sort of commune or something, an entire society based on that. And so if you used up your woods, your forests, if you used up the land, future generations would be thrown into poverty. And it was your godly duty to make sure that didn't happen.
Now, the New England town, you talk about that being a model for later thought about how to construct cities. And I think also the relationship between the city and the town, the city and the land, mm-hmm. the urban environment versus the land. How do you see that unfolding?
It was really remarkable to me. I mean, as I mentioned before, I started this project just trying to see how your religious background shaped your attitudes towards nature and the environment. But as I was trying to structure the book, trying to figure out how can I tell this story that's not just a series, a series of chapters about, okay, we're going to talk about Presbyterians in the next chapter. Okay, now the Methodists, and as a kind of a
encyclopedia
of everybody, which would be dreadfully dull. How could I arrange this into some sort of story? And as I began to put them into chronological order, and then realized that the conservation and environmental movement is dominated in succession by different people from different denominations, which was really remarkable. And says a whole lot about the sources and the values of the environmental movement at these crucial moments. And in the 19th century, it turns out that just about everybody involved with conservation, forestry, and parks all came out of a small town in western New England and a congregational church. So that these values, at first pretty explicitly, are related to the New England town. Some of the early ones, George Perkins Marsh, were animated, in fact, by the desire to save the New England town. By the 19th century, the railroad is starting to come into these communities, bringing the market economy, undercutting the sustainable agriculture that they've been maintained for 200 years. Bringing in cheap Western grains that they couldn't compete with. And so it forced them to abandon grains and to start growing or raising dairy cattle or whatever it might be for the market. And the New England town really begins to deteriorate. And so the first conservationists are trying to figure out how to save the New England town, partly because they like the New England town, and partly because they believed the New England town was the most moral, orderly system in the country, and that it should be a model for the new states that were coming in to the West. And so it's not only saving New England, but also saving America.
Well, the railroad would have definitely made a difference in terms of local economy. It destroyed a local economy.
Exactly. And we're dealing with that today. It's really kind of the first hint of globalization. We have this exact same problem today. If you try to create a sustainable local economy, how can you compete when, cheap apples from New Zealand or cheap lettuce from Mexico or something comes in and makes it very, very difficult to try to come up with a sustainable system.
Well, you talk about the development of the national park system. But one thing that caught my eye that I didn't expect when you talked about Frederick Olmsted and the New York Central Park, the development of the design, what Olmsted was trying to do in designing the park, which I didn't expect that I was going to find that in your book, but talk a little bit about city parks and national parks.
One of the things that these New England towns had, again, it's pretty much unique in America, was that they had common lands for everybody's use. Some of the land in the center of town was reserved for the meeting house. But they kept some of the common lands for use of future generations as they knew the population would expand. But by the early 19th century, these commons were beginning to lose their economic purpose. Many of them had been, grazed cattle on them or whatever it may have been. And they began to turn them into more recreational areas, plant trees on them and turn them into what were essentially parks. We see this already with the Boston Commons. It's being turned from a commons where that was used economically for poor people and so on into a region for everybody to kind of come, a little area for everybody to come and enjoy nature. So there is this tradition, again, that comes out of New England towns, and we find people like Olmsted and others, the proponents of the park, who tend to all come out of New England, are again saying, you know, what we really need in New York is a park, a place for people to come to, it's the works of nature. It makes the works of nature available to even poor people who can't get out to, like the rich people can, to go vacation in the White Mountains or up in the Adirondacks or up the Hudson River. And it sort of had a moral effect on society. It had a moral purpose, had a democratic purpose. It was there for everyone, of all rich and poor. It was a place where rich and poor could be together in a non-class situation. So it's very much coming out of this kind of New England mentality. And then, of course, the parks catch on and they begin to, every town wants to have one.
And Olmsted was very deliberate in how he designed New York Central Park.
Exactly.
Everything about it was thought out, that it was supposed to be reflective.
It was not an inspiring landscape at all when he got it. But he had this very almost Edenic kind of image in his mind, very similar to the way that Eden had been painted by Hudson River School and by English painters. But a place to kind of get away from the city, where the city would be kind of walled off by trees and you get away from the hustle and bustle and noise of the city, and it becomes quiet and restful and peaceful. Many people who go to Central Park, there's a portion of the park called the Ramble. Have you been to?
Yes, Central? I have. I've been to Central Park. It's wonderful.
It is wonderful, and it's just so different from the city around it. But there's one part that's called the Ramble that's very, very rustic with waterfalls and trails that go up and around the rocks. And they even have these rustic kind of gazebos up there made out of parts of trees that have not been finished. But it's all built. It's all been designed because there was really nothing there. So even the most natural parts of the park are designed to look natural. But, of course, it's wonderful to visit them and wonderful to climb around. And it really is very relaxing and pleasant to be among the greenery of in the midst of New York.
Now, there was a decline of Congregationalism. New England declined, Congregational declined. And then you've got the Transcendentalist and Emerson coming into this narrative. What did the Emerson and the Transcendentalist contribute to the environmental movement, or at the time, what was the thinking?
The Emerson actually was very interesting because all of the books you read about the history of the environmental movement focus so much on Emerson and Thoreau. So when I went to write my New Englander chapter, I thought, oh, this is going to be really easy. Everybody's going to be talking about Emerson and Thoreau. Nobody was talking about Emerson and Thoreau. I just was astonished. Emerson and Thoreau had nothing to do with it, which led me to this realization that the New England town was the inspiration for all of this. But Emerson does. He and Thoreau, but mainly Emerson in the late 19th century, early 20th century, really sort of took this Calvinist ethic about nature and put it into a non-theological framework and got rid of all of the communal parts of Puritanism and got rid of all of the predestination and the depravity. It's all personal possibility and remaking yourself and achieving your what's in you and all of that sort of thing. But it, of course, it's all also got a lot of getting close to the Spirit of God, the Creator, out in nature. And it sort of divorces it from a theological setting, divorces it from a church. Most of Emerson's devout followers, or even though churchgoers loved Emerson too, there's, you know, a lot of our famous people who loved Emerson most never went into the inside of a church. For them, nature was the church. So Emerson, in a way, is taking this Calvinism for a post-Calvinist generation. What I also realized was that Emerson's popularity rises and rises and peaks right around the turn of the 20th century. And it's he's got his most devoted followers at that time period. And so he's really influential before the rise of the American, you know, what we think of as environmentalism, and after the rise of conservation. People, I focus on a lot of artists in that chapter, on the Emerson chapter, but also Frank Lloyd Wright, who was devoutly Emersonian, but Ansel Adams, who was always trying to express this the spiritual value of wilderness in all of his photography. We all love those photographs. He's immensely popular. And I think for most of us, it's just a beautiful picture of Yosemite or whatever it may be. Not really realizing that he at all times had, at least in part, this kind of spiritual purpose in trying to transmit these ideas to us. It's interesting, too, to think about, you know, the incredible detail in those photographs that links pretty obviously back to the obsession with truth, the truth in the landscape, back to the painters of the 19th century. But a lot of his friends who were painters, John Marin and George O'Keefe and I'm blanking on his name.
That's all right.
Yeah, I should have had a book right next to me. Anyway, these the modernist painters, America's first modernist generation of painters, even though they're painting abstract of nature, to them, they are really getting at the truth of nature. But the truth of nature is not necessarily in its details, but rather can be expressed in an abstract way.
Now, Ansel Adams that you talk about, his photography was also...
Hartley was the name I was trying to think of.
Okay. Well, Adams was... his photographies were... Photographs were empty of people.
Exactly.
Again, that still continues.
And same way with George O'Keefe and John Marin and Marsden Hartley. Works of man and man himself tend to be gone.
And there's another thing that I see here, too, is you see this splitting off from the Congregationalist. You've got this Emersonian sort of strand of environmentalism, which tries to complete it. You could say it's always a secularized version of the religious environmentalism. Mm-hmm. And then you've got another strand going with the Presbyterians that took off where the Congregationalists left off. And you talk about John Muir there as a Presbyterian and some other people. Talk about what the Presbyterian, there were progress. This is in the Progressive era at this point.
Exactly. So this is also very fascinating. Was to find. As the Congregationalists begin to disappear in the late 19th century, and I think the reason for that is because despite their efforts, the New England Village, the New England town continues to decline, and fewer of them are actually coming out of these New England towns. and fewer of them have this congregational background. So congregationalism is changing, New England is changing, and for some reason you suddenly stop seeing congregationalists everywhere. But who steps up into to take their place with these Presbyterians beginning in the 1880s, and then just completely dominating national conservation from the 1880s all the way up to 1920.
And it's also the nation's moving west at this time. Mm-hmm. The westward movement is also going to have influence on the environmental movement.
Exactly. John Muir moving west from Wisconsin. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yes, I'm just thinking about them going westward. And as they go westward, it seems like there's more congregationalism is sort of declining. Presbyterians are picking it up because they're moving west with the population.
A lot of congregationalists, when they left New England, the congregational churches were so tied to the community, they would find themselves in places where there was no congregational church, and they would end up in a Presbyterian church because Presbyterians were also Calvinists, and they also had this Puritan background, but they had a very different ethic. They're not so local like the congregationalists were, and they have this strong preaching tradition of preaching righteousness to the nation, going all the way back to John Knox, who founded Scottish Presbyterianism. It's a much more of an ethnic church overall. A lot of Scots, think of Scots as Presbyterians, and it had a very strong Scottish character. Scotland never really had a very strong communal ethic. It's a kind of a clan-based society, more rural, and this attempt that the Puritans in America had to kind of create the just, sustainable community didn't really take effect in Scotland. But they certainly very Calvinist, and very much concerned about the destruction of greed and avarice, especially on God's works. They're really, really strong on natural theology, the writing of books about finding God in nature, writing both popular books that were popular in America, and more theological books. So they have this different ethic. We have a series of Presbyterian presidents. There's only two or three Presbyterian presidents who I'm talking about who were raised Presbyterian before Cleveland, Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison. And since the last one, who was Woodrow Wilson, we have had no presidents raised Presbyterian. So we have Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison and Theodore Roosevelt, and then Woodrow Wilson, who also had a series of Presbyterian secretaries of the interior, secretaries of agriculture. Just absolutely never in American history have Presbyterians had so much effect. And they really were the ones who created conservation and the parks movement as a national movement. They're the ones who created the national forest. They're the ones who created the national park system. It's all comes from this national era of Presbyterians. And Presbyterians will go on to dominate the rise of the environmental movement. Rachel Carson, the famous author of Silent Spring, her grandfather and her uncle were Presbyterian ministers. Edward Abbey, the famous author and advocate of wilderness, his mother was the organist in a Presbyterian church in Western Pennsylvania. David Brower, the head of the Sierra Club in the 1960s, who transformed the Sierra Club from a little hiking club to a national environmental organization. He was raised Presbyterian. The list goes on and on and on. It's absolutely amazing. I just kept finding everybody I would look at. I would say to myself, okay, let's look at this person and go back and trace their origins. And another person had come out of the Presbyterian church.
But there's a little shift there that you note in your book, particularly when you talk about Rachel Carson and Alice Hamilton. You mm-hmm. talk about how the shift went from nature, preserving nature for itself, because it was displaying the glory of God and all those wonderful things, to mm-hmm. we've got to preserve nature because it's affecting humanity. We are poisoning ourselves. We are, so there's a slight shift from sort of earth-centered to human welfare center that the women take up.
That was very interesting, too. I was, because in each of these, and one of the things about environmental history, because it's so outdoorsy, how do you bring women into the story? It's kind of a problem with the entire environmental history field, bringing women in. You can do it sort of self-consciously. I tried to do it more as naturally as possible, bring them in. And I was wondering, where are the Presbyterian women? And all of a sudden, four very influential women come along, all from the East. They're not from the Grand West. We associate John Muir and Edward Abbey and David Brower and all these guys with the big open spaces of the West. It's rather their East Coast, small town kind of backgrounds. One of them, as you mentioned, is Rachel Carson. And another is Alice Hamilton, who is from Indiana, who would be the one to really found industrial medicine. When we think of environmental contamination and our places where we work and where we live, this was Alice Hamilton's concern. She really pioneers that. She becomes the first professor of industrial medicine in the first chair at Harvard. In order to do that, to give her a job, she was the first woman in the Harvard Medical School faculty. Now, they looked for a man who would fill that position, but couldn't find one as qualified as Alice Hamilton. And so that's where she made her mark. We also have Jane Jacobs, who we usually think of in terms of urban areas. She has a famous book, came out around the time that Silent Spring came out in the early 60s. About the death and life of American cities, how to make a city livable. And basically, you want to keep those freeways from, you know, plowing through the middle of your town, and various ways to make a city walkable. Part of what we think of as the environmental movement today, to make keep a city alive and keep those cars out. James Jacobs was raised Presbyterian. And I also talk about Annie Dillard, who was raised in Western Pennsylvania. And kind of comes back to the old tradition of natural theology in how can we today in this modern world think about the presence of God in nature.
Now, all these women are concerned with human welfare and
exactly.
The environment and how it's going to affect how we live and what the quality of our life. And then there's this other thing that's coming in there, too. And then you start talking a little bit about the Baptists. And about the individualism, okay, mm-hmm. And how from an individualistic sort of Baptist ethic, what the viewpoint of the environment is from that viewpoint. And it has like a double-edged sword, it mm-hmm. seems. On one hand, the environment is, you know, under man's domination to do as man wants. But on the other hand, there's this wanting to get away from government and society and live your own life. And you can only do that if you can learn how to sustain yourself just from the land.
Exactly right. Well, very well put. There's something in the Baptists are the dissenters in New England society, that they don't believe in this communal ethic. That God works differently in their theology. They were supposed to proselytize, to evangelize to all of society, and as soon as every person accepted Jesus in their heart, then we'd all behave like Christians, and all of our social problems and our environmental problems would magically go away. So the focus of baptism, the Baptist Church, and which I think had been really, really influential in American history, the sort of Baptist personal ethic that let's all just individually start doing the right thing, and then let's all recycle, let's all buy electric cars or whatever, then somehow it will, you know, we don't need the government. It just rely on individual action. And all those Baptists that I talk about in that chapter, that seems to be a theme running through there, is a kind of mistrust of government solutions and a trust that if we could just get everybody to think about nature in the right way, then and the environment, then our problems will be solved.
And one of the people that you talk about is, which I thought was very interesting, was Scott Nearing in his book, Living the Good Life, mm-hmm. and how that became sort of a Bible in a certain era of American environmentalism. Talk about Scott Nearing. Was he Baptist, if I recall?
He was definitely Baptist, yes, and was thinking of going into the ministry at one point, but he was at a Philadelphia Baptist church. This was during the Progressive Era, and the mayor was going to go in there and clean up the corruption in Philadelphia, and then the next thing you know, the Baptist minister was on board, and the next thing you know, the Baptist minister was saying, "Well, no, we better not do that." And he realized that he'd been influenced by corruption, so he leaves the Baptist church and he decides not to become a minister. But his basic idea is, yes, let's, he goes off to Vermont and Maine and, builds his own little home and tries to be, completely self-sufficient. This is the 1930s when he does that, when it looks like American capitalist society has collapsed. And perhaps the best thing we can do is just, you know, go back to the land and tend our own gardens. Then they published this book, Living the Good Life. It was in 1954, I think, in the 1950s.
I don't have the date.
Yeah, it's around that time. I think it's the centennial, very close to the 100 years since Walden was published. And so they look back to Walden as kind of their, you know, with the same idea that Thoreau had. And Thoreau was very much of this mentality of thinking about your life and thinking, you know, not getting caught up in the courts of the capitalist world or thinking about money and sort of living for these higher things. But again, Thoreau was very individualistic. It's hard to find any community in Walden or any of his books.
And this is what was so ironic, because you talk about Thoreau being such a hero for the environmental movement at a certain point in the 60s, 70s. And
still today.
And still today. And if you really look at Thoreau, he was very individualistic. It was very much about him. Self-actualization.
Exactly right. Which appeals to us in these, you know, in the modern era. This is, seems to be since the 60s. It's how we, I think that's why he's become so popular.
And then you go on, you do mention Wendell Berry, who is so hugely popular. People just love Wendell Berry because he's such a great writer, but you talk about his ethic also coming out of that sort of individualist sort of going out and, you know, living off the land, which is not really necessarily too good for women, by the way.
Well, you know, that brings up a great point. I had the hardest time finding Baptist women who said anything about nature. There's a couple in that chapter, but I, in a way, kind of bent over backwards to find some.
Well, I have
it's
a question.
That's the thing. You're right.
I have a big overall question. It seemed like through all the book, all these people who are talking about nature in a various and sundry ways all have a very sort of idyllic, nature is beautiful and sublime and nurturing. And it was always about all the good things. But there seems to be very little recognition about the wildness of nature in terms of nature is violent. It can be ruthless. It's dangerous. It's unpredictable. And it doesn't care about you. I mean, if you are on a mountain and it starts raining or there's a storm and things are happening, it's not going to stop for you.
Exactly right. But some people like John Muir gloried in that. That was part of God's plan, too. That was how God made the mountains, was with these snowstorms and so on.
And there's a lot of devastation that happens with nature on its own.
Yes. Right.
You know, floods and, you know, blizzards, and it's not always idyllic and wonderful and nurturing and embracing you and calling you.
Yes. Right. I agree. It's
Was there any recognition of this in any of this literature or paintings or things that you looked at that there was a sense of, hey, you know what? There is this other side to nature. There's this wildness to it.
Well, except that as the wildness represented an aspect of the divine. That I don't know that I can't, I'm trying to remember, aside from your people dealing with it explicitly, you do have the famous passage in Thoreau when he climbs Mount Katahdin and realizes this is not made for man. We do not belong up here. This is wild nature that's just heartless and pitiless. Let me go back to Concord, which is this beautiful little town.
And a lot of people who try to live off the land end up starving to death.
Right. It's not easy to do if you don't know what you're doing.
Exactly. Right? So it's not always benevolent. And
no. It's like that Krakauer book about the guy who died in Alaska.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of, so yeah, that's just interesting. That seems to be sort of missing from all the story. Not that you overlooked it, but I'm just saying that it seems to be there a blind spot there about considering all the aspects of nature, if we're really going to come to terms with it and really live with it in a positive way. We've got to understand the negative aspects too. So where is the environmental movement today? It looked like, from what you're saying, it's the bureaucratic organizations have taken over the environmental movement, and that there really isn't a grassroots movement any longer.
I wouldn't go so far to say that. I think there's a lot of grassroots activity. I do point out the fact that there's no major Presbyterian environmentalist, not a single one, who was born after 1945. So this is the last generation with that kind of, the Presbyterian Church is evolving just like everything does, and it's losing that Calvinist edge. It's becoming, when you think of Presbyterians today, you think of the nicest people. They're just so, very middle class, and they really are just nice liberal folks by and large. But 100 years ago, they were not. They were dour and severe and censorious. And that's made leaders out of this sort of mix is what raises people like Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir. But so what does it mean then that this was the question I asked, that the Presbyterians disappear? One thing it does is it makes room for other kinds of leaders. And I point out there's three groups that really are most prominent in environmentalism since the 70s. The Catholics are very prominent in a couple areas, especially environmental justice, and also in it's kind of this more cosmological attitude towards the history of the universe as sort of the history of creation, of God's creation. Kind of attitude that if we think of creation as this, the product of this long story of God, that we'll take better care of it. Catholics also tend to have many of them, a kind of a sacramental attitude towards nature, which is different from the Protestant attitude. It's nature's a sacrament and a way to come to God, way for grace to reach us. Then we also have, African-American Baptists, Black Baptists, who were very prominent in the organization of the environmental justice movement in Warren County, North Carolina, in the early 80s. In the 80s and 90s, the rise of the eco-justice movement in African-American communities very frequently involves a Baptist church or meetings in the Baptist church or something like that. And then the third group would be Jews, who've been prominent in a variety of different ways. But I think the field that would be easiest to bring up and to be most familiar to most people would be in the natural foods movement. Michael Pollan, for example.
Well, one thing that was you just brought up African Americans that come very late into the story. And I was thinking about why is that? And basically, maybe because African Americans have a different relationship to the land. The land is labor, intensive labor, and a lot of this environmental movement, the early 19th century and early 20th century, is based on an idea of this sort of restful, peaceful, time that really mm-hmm. you had to be affluent and have leisure time to do mm-hmm. these things, okay, to sit there and just contemplate. African Americans and other people, probably lower class people, are working the land. And mm-hmm. the land is, they don't have a romantic notion of the land because it's just hard.
But I would, that's true to agree, but I do want to point out that many people in the 19th century, like John Burroughs or John Muir, definitely as young people worked hard in the land. And it's not just a middle class movement or an urban movement, as in many books that they tend to kind of emphasize that. I think there is a, what's going on with African Americans tends to be more that Southerners do not look at the land in this way. The Southern attitude towards landscape has been much more utilitarian, exploitative, even going back to the slave system and the slave plantation. So certainly they know land through labor, but you could say that every farmer, everybody who grows up in a rural area loves nature. They love to go hunting and fishing and to be outside and enjoy the wind and the rain and the cool temperatures or whatever. There's no reason not to think that they're not enjoying nature and enjoying the beauty of the mountains, perhaps, as well. But they don't have the same sort of theological or ideological framework for it that you have in these amongst the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians and various other people outside of the South. So part of it is that what is, I think, made the African-Americans different from your other Southerners is that they have a communal experience that's unlike white Southerners. White Southerners are, like the Baptists, extremely individualistic. They don't like government. They don't like taxes. The environmental movement in the South is weaker than anywhere else, and for this reason. But African Americans were a community both because the whites forced them to be one, and they lived in the slave quarters. So if you look at New England, you've got these New England towns. The community is the New England town. The South has no towns or very few. It's not an urban people. It's a very rural people. But the one place that you did have people in a community would be the slave quarters. So there is this tradition of blacks helping one another. And the one institution that is allowed by whites in slavery and it survives slavery to the modern day is the church. So it remains a kind of a center for the community. And the black, the Baptist preacher is a spokesman for the community and to a go-between the black community and the white society. And so the church has this sort of this other purpose as well, so that there is a community in the South, and it seems mainly wrapped around the black church. You do not see, I can't find any example where whites who are also poor and maybe it's some sort of suffering some environmental ill or other who organize in their churches in the same way. It's very much characteristic of the African-American community in the South and the North that you just don't see among Southern whites.
Mark, we're out of time. This is a very interesting conversation. I'd like to continue. You have been very generous with your time. I really appreciate you
coming on. Thank you very much for.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Drop me a line at newbooks.americanstudies@gmail.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.